Talkback Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning, Deb.
Lovely to have you in Sophie's stead today. Brett Draper, horticulturalist, garden centre manager, all-round good guy. So if you've got a question for Brett, we'll get into general Talkback Gardening shortly on 1300 222 891. But first, we're going to have a bit of a look at begonias in a moment. And who's going to tell us about that?
Absolutely, Deb. You know, Dr. Tate Hancocks is here and he's actually going to take us through the wonderful world of begonias. So we're going to learn what sort of varieties are out there, how we can care for them, and how we can propagate some of them.
Fantastic. So if you've got a begonia question, call now on 1300 222 891. We love your comments on the text line on 0467 922 891. I have a couple of ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away a little later, one by phone and one by text. So get ready for that as well. Straight up, Beck and Raddy and Alan sent through a beautiful picture of a rose, absolutely stunning. Dunning says, first rose from my garden for you at Victor. Up today, late start from Manham, overcast and grey, warm and hopefully a nice day. And thank you so much. Always love to hear from you, Beck. If you'd like to send a text through, we'd like to receive that, please, on 0467 922 891. Well, let's introduce our very special guest this morning, please, Brett Draper.
Yeah, so this morning we are fortunate enough to have the Vice President of the Begonia Society of South Australia, Dr. Tate Hancocks, who is also the PALS State Coordinator.
Now, what is PALS?
Yeah, what's PALS? Tate, can you tell us what PALS actually is?
Okay, so PALS is a group of begonia lovers from across Australia. They are a kind of a subgroup that work on an ex situ conservation program. So ex situ means out of the natural environment, usually in home gardens or botanic gardens and places like that. They grow species begonias. There's about 2,000 species begonias across the world. They're found in places like Africa, Asia, North and South America. We don't have any in Australia, but we do have some to the north in Papua New Guinea, which is interesting.
Wow. And so what does the acronym PALS actually stand for?
So PALS stands for the Protectors and Lovers of Species.
Ah, very, very good. How many species of begonias do we have here in Australia? And are they a native species or are they introduced?
We have no native species in Australia. We have a couple hundred, maybe up to 300-400 species being grown by gardeners and collectors and botanic gardens across the country.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that is totally incredible. I actually didn't realise there were so many species around the world either. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about plants. You don't know what you know until you don't know it.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, so, Tate, I thought this morning we might just touch on, you know, what home gardeners, for instance, might know what sort of varieties are out there. And also, you know, and because most people would be familiar with bedding begonias and maybe cane begonias because they're readily available. You'll find them through nurseries and garden centres. But, of course, there's lots more out there that are available. What are some of the other varieties that people might have seen? Like, you know, are they, I don't know, you tell us what they might be. So,
all right, begonias are grouped horticulturally into 8 classes. There's the canes that people often see, things like Mrs. Hashimoto, which is a white cane begonia, Sophie Cecile, which has lovely big reddy coloured leaves. They are quite tall, often called angel wing begonias. Then we've got tuberous begonias. You'll often see them at the nurseries and things. They go dormant over winter and then come back up and often have large flowers, or they have lots of bright big flowers compared to the rest of the genus. We have Rex begonias, which are loved by people across the globe, especially in tropical areas. Unfortunately, in Adelaide and most of South Australia, they kind of throw a paddy over winter. They get lots of pests and diseases and often go from being these luscious rhizomatous things to these snail worm-like looking things in pots.
And can I jump in there? So the Rex begonias are often really spectacular in their leaf colour and pattern. Am I right? Is that the sort
of... Yes.
So people might see them and they might have, you know, sort of an amazing sort of, I don't know how you describe it, almost half spherical sort of patterning to the leaves and really, really cool colours in them. So they're would it be fair to say maybe more grown for their foliage and not necessarily their flowers? Or what would people grow them for?
Yeah, Rex begonias are definitely grown for their flowers. I'm sorry, their leaves. Their flowers are pretty inconspicuous. They do have some nice flowers. They're moderately sized, but they tend to be either at the foliage height or just above. If you want flowering rhizomatous begonias, you're going to go for some of the more tough, hardy varieties that can be found and grown by lots of gardeners in South Australia.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, I particularly like tuberous begonias because of the flowers. It's a bit hard sometimes, but the flowers on some of the tuberous begonias are just spectacular. And the fact that, you know, it comes from, you know, something that is dormant and there's nothing there and all of a sudden it comes alive and has these most spectacular flowers. Do you have a favourite begonia?
Oh, do I have a favourite begonia? I really love cane begonias. I really love Sophie Cecile. It was a cane begonia that a friend of mine who passed away gave me before she passed away. It's really hardy. It's got lovely foliage. And when it flowers, it's lovely big bunches of pink flowers.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Now, obviously, begonias, the different species grow differently. We've talked about, you know, some are canes, some are from rhizomes, some are from tubers. But are there any that are easier to grow than others? So if someone is wanting to grow some and maybe have not grown them before, what would you suggest would be maybe some of the easier ones for people to grow?
All right. I would start with canes and rhizomatous. They're the easiest to grow, especially in South Australia. You don't need any particular soil, any particular climate, really. They just need somewhere shady that gets bright indirect light. A gardener's favourite thing to try and work out where that is.
Yes, yeah.
But they're quite adaptable. So I have them under pergolas, I have them under trees, I have them in all sorts of spaces.
And when you say they're quite adaptable, are they a little bit more forgiving as
yes.
well, maybe, than some of the other ones? So they're yes. a good one that if you are going through that process as a gardener of a little bit of trial and error in finding that right spot, they will stand up a little bit more, you know, to a little bit more harsher treatment than until you find that right sweet spot for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, look, we might get into the care of begonias in a moment, but we are inviting your questions. We've got Fran who's on the line. So if you would like to actually mine the mind of Dr. Tate Hancock's on begonias, call in now on 1300 222 891, 1300 222 891, and he can answer your questions.
Talk Back Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
We are talking about begonias this morning. Dr. Tate Hancock is in the studio. Brett Draper is our special Talk Back Gardener this morning, stepping in for Sophie Thompson. Before we get on to our calls, did you have anything else that you wanted to raise before we get into, you know, how to actually care for begonias with Tate?
Well, there's lots to raise, Deb, but I think maybe we just get into the calls and just see what happens from there.
Yeah, why don't we? Fran from Walkley Heights is on the line. Good morning, Fran.
Oh, good morning, Deb, and good morning, Dr. Hancock. I have been given a cane begonia. Its flowers are called fairy wings. The leaves are a light burgundy colour. It has been neglected and it needs pruning. It has leaves and some flowers at the very end of the canes. I need to know how to prune it and also which fertiliser would you recommend, because I don't think it's ever been given a fertiliser.
Alrighty. So fairy wings is, I think, actually a Semper Florens rather than a cane begonia, but you look after them very similarly. What you'll need to do, pruning-wise, now is a great time to prune. You cut them back to about 10, 15 centimetres from the ground. You'll need to go back to the junction where the leaves are or were, where there's a little, it's like a little conical-shaped bud. If there's no bud there, it means that the plant probably flowered from that location, and begonias either have a growth bud or they have an inflorescence that comes out from the leaf. They don't have both, which is unusual in the plant world. So what you'll do is you'll cut it back to a growth bud. That will remove most of the plant, and then over the next 6 months it will triple, double in size, and you'll have a lovely display again. I usually fertilise with a slow-release pelletised fertiliser, available from all good gardening centres, or you can use a slow-release, liquid fertiliser, whether that's organic-based or inorganic-based.
Okay, and also, Dr. Hancock, it's in a 10-inch wide pot. Would you suggest repotting it?
Over the summer, does it wilt really quickly?
No.
Then I would leave it in that
actually,
pot.
Well, actually, that's wrong. I've only been given it recently, and she's not here to ask her.
All right. I would say have a go in that 10-inch pot this year. If it wilts really quickly over the summer, you'll probably be watering it once every 4 days to every couple of days in a 10-inch pot.
Yes.
Too much water and they will rot, but they're really good at telling you when they need to be watered. They have, they drop, their leaves will wilt really quick, or they might get a colour change and they'll go from like a luscious green to like a silvery green. And it's at that point that you're like, oh, need to get some water onto them.
Yeah, and I think that's important with lots of plants, isn't it? Observation and knowing the signs, particularly with plants that might be sensitive to wet feet, for instance. So only water them when you can see that change in the plant, when the foliage goes down or the colour doesn't look quite right, rather than watering for the sake of watering. You water it when the plant needs it.
Fantastic.
Well, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Fran. You've raised a lot of great issues there. Really appreciate the call. If you've got a begonia question, Dr. Tate Hancock's and Brett Draper are here, 2-for-1 on 1300 222 891. Kerry has called in from Port Lincoln. Good morning, Kerry.
Good morning.
Now, you've got a cane begonia.
I have got a cane begonia. It sounds like the one that was described earlier, big bunches of pink flowers, and I've taken cuttings off it, etc. It's been going really well. Of late, over the last 6 months, I'm finding that some of the leaves were either on the tips or right near the stem, go sort of soft and change colour just in a patch and eventually fall off. And I'm sort of tossing up, am I overwatering, underwatering? Just wondering what might be going on with that.
That's interesting.
Can I jump in there? Is it, Kerry, is it the end of the leaves? Like whereabouts on the leaves is it happening?
Yeah, so sometimes it's on the pointy end of the leaf, right at the end. I'm looking at one now. It's actually on one of the edge points, but not right at the end. It's sort of in the middle. It's not going dry and quick. This is what I'm thinking, maybe I'm over watering because it's not dry. It goes quite soft. But sometimes it's happening also right at the stem, but at the base of the stem where it meets the leaf.
What colour is it at the base of the leaf and on the stem? Does it get sort of a powdery white before it goes that browny colour?
No.
No. It could be cold. We've had a bit of a cold winter, especially in Lincoln. You guys have that extra sea breeze, which I'm familiar with. My family's from Port Lincoln. So I've spent quite a bit of time over there. So they could be getting a bit cold, which when they get cold, they tend to get these funny spots that go soft and discolour. Or if it's got wet, quite wet over winter, is it in the ground or is it in a pot?
No, they're in pot. I've got sort of two other in pots, and I've sort of been fairly aware that because we go away and I've got, they're in a shade area, shade house sort of thing, but they do get wet, but I have put them under the veranda or out of the wet, because I've been suspecting that it has been overwatering. But, yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, yeah.
Yeah, I suspect, Kerry, from what you're telling us, and you know, Tate's, you know, sort of drilled down to where I was going to go anyway, but I suspect it's probably more to do with climatic conditions and what we're experiencing that's causing it. So, you know, just that cold, and plants do all sorts of weird and wonderful things when they're exposed to conditions that they're not used to, and you know, it can present itself in so many things. I guess the key thing will be you're aware of it, you monitor it, you're not overwatering it by the sounds of it, and do you remove those?
Is it best to sort of just err on the side of underwatering? And I heard you say previously that another plant will tell you when it needs water.
Absolutely. That's a great rule of thumb for every situation. Yeah. It's better to underwater. More people kill their plants with kindness than they do with neglect.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks, Kerry. Okay. Good luck with that.
Thank you, and thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in. Just a few text questions for you, if you don't mind, Tate. Karen first has sent through an absolutely stunning picture to all of you. You can't see it, Tate, but we can, of photos of begonias from her trip to the Daylesford Botanical Gardens. Thank you, Karen. Absolutely gorgeous. Jean asks, can you keep cane begonias as indoor plants, and does it need to go outside to get sun to flower?
You can keep them as indoor plants. I've kept them as indoor plants. They do best in a really bright window, usually east-facing or south-facing. They will flower inside. I've had cane begonias flower. I've also had lots of rhizomatous ones that I grow in terrarium conditions flower.
Okay, and Rosie wanted to know, can they be grown in pots? Or Ray, sorry.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Grow them in pots. Okay. Grow them in the ground, whatever you like.
Now, Patrick says, funny thing about begonias, I really do not like how they smell. Pretty much the only one in the category. I guess it's like some people don't like coriander.
It could be. Some have quite fragrant, pleasant smells. Others have really grassy smells, especially when you're cutting them back and managing them.
Okay, and finally from Mandy in Collinswood, a beautiful photograph says, good morning, Tate. You gave me a small cutting of a stunning red-flowered begonia a few years back through a mutual friend. I've given away more cuttings than I can remember. It is so easy to propagate, and I have the main plant just outside my bedroom window, and it's looking lovely. So I'm handing back to you, Brett, because there's a lot to cover in the next few minutes.
There certainly
with Tate.
Is, Deb. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I thought we might just touch on how to care for your begonias, and I think we'll probably just talk maybe in broad terms, because, I mean, as we've just discovered, there's so many varieties. So, and that's really important. I mean, some of the callers have touched on that today, is understanding, you know, what to do and how to actually care for them. But, you know, I guess if we take maybe, you know, cane begonias, which most people seem to have, what sort of care, or in general terms, what sort of care is the best thing?
Cane begonia care is quite simple. You'll start in October by pruning them. You cut them back by a half, sometimes two-thirds. Sometimes you can cut them all the way to about an inch off at the ground. They're designed so that they send up lots of new canes from the ground, and it's on those new canes that you'll get flowers either this year or next year. When they start to grow, you want to give them regular feeding liquid or slow release, but don't do both, because you don't want to burn their fine, sensitive roots.
Right. So it's important not to overstimulate them.
Yes. No one likes to be overstimulated, and plants are the same.
Yeah. So that's cane begonias. I mean, I guess maybe we might just touch on rhizomatous begonias as well, because obviously they're the ones, like, I guess, your Rex begonias and things that people really like. That care is going to be slightly different, I imagine.
Yes. Rhizomatous begonias, you start in the spring, you get rid of the old daggy leaves. They put on a fresh flush of growth in October. And then you'll also get, at the same time, the flowers. And they are usually held quite a distance away from the foliage and what a lot of people grow them for. Those leaves start to harden up, you're able to take cuttings, which can be propagated in, like, jars of water that you sit on your kitchen sill, or in my case, on the kitchen sill, in the bathroom, in my bedroom.
wherever there's an appropriate spot or space, by the sounds of it, maybe.
Absolutely.
Now, and that also then comes to the next point that I wanted to touch on, and that was, you know, the position for them. And, you know, does somebody have to have, you know, a glass house or a terrarium to grow them? You know, can they be grown outside, when we touched on that before, can they be growing outside? Or if they're growing inside, for instance, where is the best place to actually do that?
Outside, they can be grown in most places. If you can provide them shade for the afternoon, whether that's under 50 or 70% shade cloth, they can be grown under trees, under verandas, on front porches, on balconies. The more temperamental things like to have that little bit of extra protection, so you can grow them in pots inside, somewhere that gets that bright light. Without that bright light, they tend to grow lanky and leggy and they won't flower as much.
Look, Jane from Marden, we can squeeze a question in from her. Good morning, Jane.
Oh, hi, back to cane begonias. Please, I'm frightened of them. I love them to bits, but they scare me when I say you bring one home from the nursery and now it's time to plant. So you plant it, do you stake it? And if then, when do you cut it back after it's grown, please? This is a cane begonia.
Thanks, Jane.
Cane begonias, generally from the nursery, are going to be, there's only a few that are sold locally. They will probably need staking, especially the maculata types, the ones with the big spotty leaves. It's really good idea to stake them, especially initially.
And they're commonly called the polka dot begonias, yes, aren't they? People might know them as that, yeah.
So they'll need to be staked probably for the first 12 months. Once their new growth comes up from the ground, it's often thicker and stronger and you're able to get away without staking them. They will get mildew over winter. Don't stress, because I have something like 90 varieties. Every single one is covered in mildew. They've all been cut back to between, some of them are at ground level, thank you rats, some of them are a foot high. So you don't need to stress overly too much, as long as when you cut them back, you can see those nice nodes with the buds in them.
Okay, Jane, I hope that helps you out there. Thank you very much for calling in. And on the same topic, someone says, I'm listening and would like to prune my cane begonia. However, the stems are long with no buds along the stem, though there are leaves with flowers at the top.
Then you're probably going to have to go even harder. Often they'll have to go down to the very base. As long as you can't see the rounded bud scar or the scar on the stem above the leaf, there should be a dormant bud in there. If you can see that scar where the inflorescence was, which is the bit that holds the flowers, then it's not going to grow from there.
Well, Mandy, we've got Margaret from Mount Barker. This will definitely be our last question. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. I've had what I think is a cane begonia for 25 years. Somebody gave it to me. Been in a pot since I moved to Mount Barker last year. I thought I'd lost it last year in winter, but it came back again. This year it lost all its leaves in winter, but it's just coming back again, new leaves on it. But it's got a lot of dead wood in there. Can I take it out of the pot and get rid of the dead bits and, you know, get more plants?
Yeah, absolutely. You can take it back to near ground level and even divide it and replant it. They have really shallow root systems, so they respond really well to doing that.
Thanks, Margaret. And we heard from Mandy on the text line that propagation's very easy, but I don't think we've got a lot of time to cover that topic, unfortunately.
Time's going to beat us this morning on that, Deb, but that might be a good opportunity to get Tate back into the studio at some stage to talk through that. So as you can see, I mean, so many people are just so interested in begonias, and there's just a thirst of knowledge out there for people wanting to do the right thing and where and where to get that information from. But I guess, you know, that's what the Begonia Society of South Australia is all about, really. And you've got a show coming up next weekend where people will be able to come to the show and have a look at the different varieties. They'll be able to talk to experienced members about how to grow these particular varieties and also buy some of these beauties. Do you want us to tell us just briefly a little bit about the show, where it is and what time, that sort of stuff?
So our show is at the Klemzig Community Centre. It will be from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. It might be till 4. I can't quite remember, but let's say till 3. There's going to be lots of rhizometers, lots of canes available for sale, and they are the varieties that gardeners in South Australia can grow, and they grow really well for
Wonderful.
Us.
Well, I hope you've sent a notice through to us at adelaideweekends@abc.net.au. Look, Tate, Dr. Tate Hancock, Vice President of the Begonia Society of South Australia and PALS, Protectors and Lovers of Species Coordinator, thanks so much for joining us in the studio this morning. Always great to catch up with you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We will continue our general talk about gardening very shortly.
Talkback Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening. Good morning, Brett Draper.
Good morning, Deb.
Great to have you in the chair for Sophie Thompson today. And if you've got any questions at all, jump straight on the blower. 1300 222 891. Brett is here to answer your questions. I've got a couple of ABC Gardening magazines to give away, one by phone, one by text. If you'd like to try and win it by text, don't send it now. Send it when we ask you to call. But we need your full name and postal address on that as well. Also coming up, we've got a few things to chat about this morning, and we might start with one of them right now, Brett, and I think that is citrus gall wasp.
Yes, Deb. So citrus gall wasp is probably one of those pesky little pests in the last few years that's really become quite prevalent in Adelaide in particular. The citrus gall wasp emergence dates have been released. So we now know when the citrus gall wasps are expected to emerge from their galls. So their galls are the swelling on the citrus trees. It's generally in last year's growth where you'll find these galls or swelling of the stems that are there. And the actual emergence date for Adelaide is looking like that it will be the 16th of October, which I think is this coming Thursday. So for people that are wanting to protect their trees from the possible risk of being reinfected, now is the time to get your kaolin clay spray onto your trees. So you need to get that onto them prior to the emergence if you can. So this weekend would be ideal if you can, but certainly before Thursday. And I think actually the forecast for Thursday is actually going to be 30 degrees, if I remember that from last night accurately. So the temperatures are starting to warm up, but you'll find that emergence will start from the 16th. And then the peak emergence is looking like that it will be towards the end of October, so around sort of the 28th. And then with the and it looks like that it will probably wrap up sort of by the 13th or 14th of November. So the important thing is, if you're going to protect your tree with a kaolin clay based spray, is to get that on now. And you'll probably need to do a follow-up in, say, 2 weeks' time, say 10 to 14 days' time. It's really, really important to do that. There are other things that you can use. So horticultural oils like pest oil and eco oil can also be used, but they're only about 70% effective in that control. The other thing to remember, Deb, is when the gall wasps emerge, when the females emerge, they mate and lay eggs and clusters of eggs on the plants in the new wood, the new soft wood, the new growth on your actual citrus. And that happens within about 3 days of their emergence. So timing is the key to actually get that on. And the other thing is, if you've got galls on a tree right now, which say maybe on a smaller tree, because large trees, it's really hard to control this on if you're cutting them out. But on a smaller tree and you can cut them out, now is the time to cut them out and dispose of them. If you can't cut them out, get your horticultural glue and paint them onto the galls. So smear the horticultural glue onto the galls, and as they emerge, they'll get stuck into that. That's not practical for a large tree, but for a small tree, say in a pot where you've got galls, you can do that.
Okay, and Helen from Glengowrie asks, can I spray when the tree is in full blossom?
Look, you've probably, if you're wanting to protect your tree, you've really got no choice. You really have to do that. So the kaolin clay is a natural based clay product, and I guess, you know, there is the potential there that, you know, it's going to affect some of the flowers that are there, but it's probably better than the alternative of having the tree really badly infected going forward.
Okay, thank you very much. And I just would say that we have got Dr. Peter Crisp from SARDI joining us next week on citrus gall wasp. So if you'd like to find out more, do tune in. But this week, is the week to get that on.
And that's fantastic, Deb. So Dr. Crisp will be able to, because he interprets the information and is able to give more accurate information or data around what is happening right here in Adelaide.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Well, we are going to jump to your calls now. Alan has called in from Strathalbyn. Alan, you've got a fig tree in a pot. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Brett and Deb. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I've got a fig. It's about 1.2 metres high. It's got growth at the bottom, growth at the top, and about 600 mil in between. It's got nothing. I'm just wondering if I to cut it off at the top so it'd sprout?
Yes, definitely you can do that. I assume it's a fruiting fig we're talking about.
It is, yes.
Yeah, okay. And it's come into full leaf now?
Yeah, it's really bushy at the top and it's got a small amount at the bottom, you know, like a little side, couple of side branches mm-hmm. with a bit of growth on that and some leaves. But the top is really, it's really bloomed. But in between it's just bare as, and it's about half an inch diameter.
Yeah. So now's a really good time. I mean, ideally, pruning probably when it was dormant would have been the best, but you didn't know that you wouldn't get growth in these areas. Right, but the opportunity now to reshape the tree is ideal, bearing in mind by doing that now, you're going to remove any possibility of there being a fruit this season in most likelihood. So as long as you're prepared to do that and happy to do that, then I would say go ahead and do it.
So I just cut it off, what, halfway up or?
Well, you could probably go a little bit harder if you wanted to, given that it's growing. So how far up is the bottom foliage going from the base of it?
It's about 300 mil.
Okay, and how big is the bare area in between before the growth at the top?
Yeah, about 600 mil.
Okay, yeah. So I would just prune back to just above where that bottom growth ceases and let it shoot out from there, because it'll actually shoot out from the bottom and come up quite vigorously from there, particularly if you cut it hard.
Oh, okay. All right, I shall do that.
All right, no worries, Alan.
Okay, thanks, Brett. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. 1300 222 891. Thanks to Malcolm, who said that John Lamb's latest Good Gardening newsletter has a whole lot of information in it about citrus gall wasps. So if you're not a subscriber, subscribe and you can get access to that and have a look at that as well. And thank you to the people who are sending through some beautiful photographs of their garden. Cheryl has sent through chameleon roses from her garden, which look absolutely stunning, and I hope they smell delicious as well. Chris has called in from McGill about an apple tree. Now, Chris, you haven't pruned it for a few years. Hello.
Quite a few years. The tree went in 2018. It was a grafted pink lady and royal gala, I think. Pink lady is a dominant one. But we just haven't been pruning it. We thought we heard that it should be pruned in summer, and we keep on putting it off, and next thing it's got the flowers and the leaves, and I can't see where to go, quite apart from which I don't know how to do it anyway.
Sure. So Chris, there's two things that you've suggested there. So generally for structural pruning of most fruit trees, and including apples, that is done during the winter months of the year when they're dormant. So if you need to cut back and reshape, for instance, because it's become out of shape, or as you've suggested, one variety is more vigorous than the other. If you've got more than one variety grafted onto a rootstock, you'll often find that one variety will always be more dominant than the other.
I prefer it as it is. I much prefer Pink Lady to anything else.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, if you wanted to do that, you could probably even get rid of the other one completely if you wanted to and just keep it as a Pink Lady. But in broad terms, if you were keeping it as two, what you would normally do is the one that's more dominant, you would need to prune more often to keep the tree in balance. So you've got a balance between mm-hmm. the two that are on that rootstock, if that makes sense. Yep. Mm-hmm. Your summer-based pruning is generally, in broad terms, to reduce the vigour of the plant. Because if you prune in winter and you prune hard, when a plant comes out of its dormancy, it tends to grow very, very vigorously. The harder you prune it, the more vigorously it grows. And often with a fruit tree, they get too tall and then people can't harvest the fruit or net the tree because they're too big. So in summer, what you do is late summer pruning. So we're talking in autumn, really late summer, early autumn, is that you reduce the height of the tree, which reduces the vigor in the plant. It changes the chemical reaction or hormones within the plant, which means that going forward, they don't shoot up to the stars again, if that makes sense. So I guess the question is at the moment, how bad the tree is and whether you think you need to reshape it or, and if so, you know, you've probably, has it come into blossom or leaf yet?
Yes, it has.
It has. Is it into full? It's pretty well underway for this season already.
Yes,
do you get good cropping off of it normally?
We have had, yes.
Yep. Oh, and I've actually
a little small because we have too many apples on the tree.
Yeah, I've actually just thought of something too. The reason why you probably have got more than one graft on the tree is for pollination. With everything going on, I sort of thought that most apples actually require pollination. So by having two varieties on there, that helps with the pollination, of course.
That's what we were told when we got it.
Yeah, so that's why it's important to maintain both of them that are on there. So look, what I would suggest at the moment is just do maybe some light reshaping of the tree, but not too hard if it's really distorted at the moment, and let it go this season. And then if you want to reduce some of the height at the end of the season in early autumn, certainly do that. But next winter, when it is dormant, that is the time to do your main structural pruning.
Yeah, we didn't need to do that because it's just got far too many branches in there.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the other thing. You want to open up the centre of the tree a little bit because it's really, really important to get good airflow through the tree, but it's also important to allow some light to come in because that light is going to hit those fruiting buds, particularly lower down on the tree, and that's where it's going to fruit from. So if it's too dense, you're going to reduce the viability of getting a crop on there.
Yeah, Chris, good luck with that. And on that very issue, someone has sent through a picture of their 30-year-old waist-high lemon, and it's chock full of lemons as well. Thank you to whoever sent that. Thank you also to Pauline, who sent through a beautiful picture of her rhododendron garden in Crayfers. Absolutely stunning. But let's talk about leaf curl in citrus. Helen in Norwood has got that problem. Hi, Helen.
Oh, hello. The leaf curl issue I have is actually with nectarines and peaches, and I didn't spray this year at all, and so I do have quite a lot of leaf curl on the trees that are in barrels. Should I be picking the leaves that are affected by leaf curl off the plant?
Yeah. Okay, Helen, this is actually great because this is one of the topics I wanted to touch on today, because I've been hammered during the week in the garden centre with people with exactly the same sort of question. And it is, you're right, it's important to remember that leaf curl affects stone fruit, peaches and nectarines and not citrus, because I've actually had several people come in during the week and saying they've got it on citrus and then it's turned out not to be. Lots of people this year, Helen, even if they have sprayed with a liquid copper or a copper-based spray at the right time, have still got really bad problems with leaf curl this year. And that's because of the climatic conditions that we've had. And we've had showery weather, and the excess moisture on the leaves as the leaves are emerging hasn't been able to dry off quick enough, and the plant hasn't been able to grow quick enough and hasn't been able to escape the fungal infection, which the leaf curl... which affects the leaf curl. So what you'll find is it's really too late to spray now for leaf curl, and that's just something that is just, you know, that's just the reality. It is too late because it has to be sprayed just prior to bud burst. And then even if you do get it at the right time, Mother Nature can change its mind and, you know, it has a very negligible effect. So in terms of picking the leaves off there that are now, I know the leaves are going to look pretty ordinary, and you know what? They're probably going to drop. So the worst of the leaves, if you wanted to, yes, go ahead. If it bothers you, pick them off. You can leave them on. They will drop off naturally, and then you can collect them and pop them into your green waste bin. And the new leaves going forward that emerge will be okay. The other thing I would suggest is nutrition is really, really important. If the plant is going to be producing a whole set of new leaves down the track, it's important to make sure if they haven't been fed that you are feeding them on a regular basis with an organic-based pelletized poultry manure fertilizer suitable for fruit and citrus trees. That would be ideal.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Helen, for the call. Lots of people, Lou earlier in the day sent a text through on the very similar issue on a Satsuma plum. So it's certainly happening. Julie in Selleck's Beach is in the very similar situation. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. Oh, we seem to have the trifecta. We've got the curling leaf and these little tiny pinhead black insects. But now I've noticed, worst of all, each of my branches are brown and around about, you know, 10 to 12 inches. Each one of them are brown. So are they dying off? Is the tree dying off?
Possibly. So when you say they're brown, what's happening? Is the foliage brown, or have they lost foliage and the end of the branches have become dry and dead?
Well, at the end of the branches are brown, and I'd take it they're dead.
Okay.
And this is the first time it's ever happened, and I nearly died when I went out and saw it.
Yeah. Julie, can I ask you, are they planted in the ground or in pots?
Yeah, in the ground.
In the ground?
In the ground, they're 4 to 5 years old. Yep. Yeah.
Okay, you need to go out and actually check and find out what is going on, if those tips are actually dead or whether it's just, for whatever reason, and I can't explain it at the moment, have lost the foliage that's on there. So grab your secateurs or a sharp blade and scrape the bark and actually just see if it's still green underneath there.
Yeah.
If it's still green underneath there, it's possible that something in the environment maybe has affected the tree and it's caused a little bit of or some sort of shock and has caused some of the foliage maybe to fall off from there. If it is dead or dry that's there, again, it's generally caused by some sort of stress. So the question will be is, have the trees been getting enough water? Have they been getting too much water? I mean, that's the thing we need to look at. And I guess the other thing is too, you know, have you fed them? Have you overfed them? Have you overstimulated them with something and burnt them maybe? And I'm not saying that you have, but they're the sort of questions that, you know, we sort of need to know. But I just wanted to touch on quickly, you mentioned about the little black pinhead insects that are on there. They're actually the peach or the black aphid. Some people call them a peach aphid. Mm. And I wanted to touch on that as well, because most of the damage that we're seeing on stone fruit right now, if it's not from the actual fungal or bacterial infection, the curl leaf, is actually from the black aphids. Now, the black aphids are at the moment having an absolute field day at the tips of new growth, at the end of the branches. And what they're doing is, obviously, they're sap suckers, which are distorting or damaging the cells in those leaves, which are causing the leaves to curl and distort. And a lot of people mistake that for actual curl leaf, but they're two different things. And they are very, very hard to control. Organically, they're exceptionally hard to control, and chemically, they're a little bit tricky as well. But there's really only one thing that I'm aware of that works really, really successfully, and that's your imidacloprid-based products, which are systemic, and you need to be aware that, you know, you need to use them as per directed and follow the withholding periods and all of that sort of stuff. But they will work really, really successfully in controlling it. Squirting them off really doesn't work. And unfortunately, your pest oils and eco oils, your horticultural oils also, the black aphids just sit there and say, you know, this is fantastic, thanks for the spray, and they just continue to damage the actual plants. Well,
Actually, we have sprayed them. We put a little bit of detergent in water and sprayed them, and that's knocked them.
Great. That's the other thing. So you can actually reduce their numbers a little bit, but lots of people have a lot of trouble controlling them, and really, really, they do quite a bit of damage to the plant.
Julie, few things to do there.
Okay, then. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Thanks to George, who sent through a picture of his hippiastrums. Says they were flowering this time last year, but in the photo on the right, taken exactly a year later on the recent Labor Day public holiday, the flowers are yet to open. I'm going to write to the council and complain about it. Thank you, George. If you've not won anything from the ABC in the last month and you'd like to win it at a Gardening Australia magazine, we'll take one call on 1300 222 891 and one text on 0467 922 891. We need your full name and postal address, and they could be yours.
Talk Back Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia, and Broken Hill.
Thank you to Kevin, who sent through a picture of his beautiful orchid cactus flowering. Beautiful. Kevin is my name. Cactus gifted years ago. I love it. I can understand why. Casey in York Peninsula joins us on Citrus Gall Wasp. Hi, Casey.
Yes, good morning. I think my questions may have been answered because I believe I was confusing the wasp with the curl leaf on my nectarine trees. So I think it's been addressed. Thank you very much anyway.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Casey. And that's great to hear. Appreciate your call. Maggie from Newton, you also had a question on kale and clay. Good morning.
I have a large lemon tree. It's had citrus gall wasps for a few years, and I tried to remove them by cutting, but then the certain time of year you can't do that because the new growth is new when they come out. So I heard you say just now that you can cut them out now, which would be great if I could, because I'd like to spray with kaolin clay, but I'm not exactly sure how you do that on a large tree, because some of the gall wasps are very large and they're right in the middle and they're hard to get to. What can you give me some advice?
Sure, absolutely. So Maggie, so your kaolin clay is a very fine clay powder which you mix into water, and the products have got really, really detailed instructions on the back of them. But broadly speaking, what you do is you mix the clay powder as per directed into a garden sprayer or some sort of spraying implement that you've got. And the important thing is to remember that when you're spraying, you need to make sure that the mixture remains agitated. So you need to continually stir it so you get a nice good coverage when you're spraying it out onto the tree. And then it really doesn't matter how big the tree is, to be honest, because you just need to spend the time in spraying it thoroughly. So you need to spray the foliage and wherever you can inside the foliage and the underneath and around and all of that, particularly the new growth, because the new growth is where, or towards the top of the growth, that's where potentially the wasps, once they emerge, are going to lay their eggs to create the next generation. If you've got galls on the tree right now where the wasps haven't emerged, the kaolin clay does not stop them from emerging. That's really important. It doesn't stop them from emerging. That's where you have to cut them out or smear the horticultural glue onto them so they get trapped as they emerge. So as long as you understand that's the way that those particular products work, if you go to a good nursery or garden centre, they will be able to talk you through the process of mixing and how to spray your tree appropriately. And as I said, follow the directions on the pack. I can't stress that enough. It's really, really important that you follow those directions. And two sprays, 2 weeks apart.
And when do you actually do the kaolin spray?
Right now.
Oh, okay.
They're due to emerge on Thursday the 16th.
But you told me that it's no use spraying them on the actual galls.
That's correct, because they don't stop the galls from emerging. What the kaolin clay does is stop the galls, once they've emerged, from reinfecting your tree in the new wood for next year.
Thank you very much for that call, Maggie. Hope it goes well. Everybody will be out there buying kale and clay. It's going to be very busy at garden centres today. Coming back to Hippie Astrom's, Mandy at Collinswood said, my hippie is yet to open too, so George, hang in there. Congratulations to our magazine winners, Vicky in South Plimpton and Amanda in Vista. I hope we got that right. Just before we let you go, soil temperatures, Brett.
Yeah.
We've been waiting for the magic 16 degrees to plant out our tomatoes. Where are we at?
We are. Well, at the moment, we're only in Adelaide about, I think, 15.3 from memory. So, and listening to Darren Ray last week, it looks like that we're probably going to be a couple of weeks out from reaching that magic number of 16 degrees. So we're probably now looking at, you know, the third to fourth week of October. Don't get me wrong, people are planting tomatoes and basil and all those warm-loving things now, but ultimately, the people that wait and plant their tomatoes once we reach that magic number generally have better success and better cropping going forward.
Okay, so wait for the magic number. Brett Draper, thanks so much for stepping into the chair for Sophie Thompson today. Really enjoyed your company.
It's been my pleasure. In fact, it's been a blast.